It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Overmatched by America's conventional military might, countries like North Korea, Russia, China, and Iran have found us vulnerable to attack in cyberspace. Today, as our entire economy goes digital, from banking to manufacturing to transportation to operating your refrigerator, the potential targets for our enemies multiply. It's cyber war. The question is, how are we fighting it? What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? What should we do to protect ourselves from hackers? And what are your concerns about cyber threats from other world powers? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. John P. Carlin is author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and the former Assistant Attorney General for National Security. John, welcome to the morning show.
Thanks, John.
You begin your book with the story of Junaid Hussein. How is he an example of how young people are radicalized online?
Yeah, and I started with that story because as I've gone around helping clients in this space, I realized how many people did not realize that there had already been a case where an individual stole information from a U.S. company with a trusted brand name, a retail company, stole personal information from customers, and then threatened them with ransomware and said, essentially, give me $500 or else I'll embarrass you by making this information public. That happens to companies all across the country every day. What made this case so unusual, though, and is why cyber is so different from other types of threats, is exactly what you mentioned, which is on the other end of the keyboard across the world was an extremist from Kosovo who had moved to Malaysia named Farizi. And really, he moved to Malaysia in part because they had better broadband access, believe it or not. And he was an extremist and did want that $500, but on the back end, he had become friends with a British citizen who had been arrested for computer hacking, radicalized while in prison, and had moved from London to Raqqa, Syria, where he was located at the very heart of the Islamic State of the Levant. And his name was Junaid Hussein. And what we were seeing at the time in terrorism cases across the country was that Junaid Hussein was at the tip of a spear of a new approach to terror that the Islamic State in the Levant had adopted. After years and billions of dollars in new departments and agencies, we had gotten very good at disrupting Al-Qaeda's old strategy, where they tried to get operatives, get recruits, bring them into Afghanistan, Pakistan, train them, and deploy them to commit a terrorist act on the scale of September 11th. And there, on September 11th, they used Western technology against us, aviation, to cause the death of innocents. What we were seeing, though, with the Islamic State in Levant, led by Junaid Hussein and his cohort, was they were taking advantage of Western technology, too. But the Western technology they were taking advantage of was social media. And what they had learned was they could reach directly into our houses and our basements to reach young people, troubled people, and try to convert them into essentially human weapons. They were crowdsourcing terrorism. And what happened was Junaid Hussein, located in Raqqa, Syria, became friends with Farizi, who was located in Malaysia. And Junaid Hussein convinced Farizi to take the information that he had stolen from this U.S. company, that customer information that was entrusted to him, and give it to him. And what Junaid Hussein did when he got a hold of that stolen information was he could care less about the $500 through Bitcoin. What he wanted to do was kill. And so what he did is he culled that list to see who looks like they're a U.S. government employee, who's got a .edu or a .gov. He created that kill list, and then again, using Western technology provided to him for free, Twitter, he blasted that list back to the United States and said, kill these people by name, by address, where they live, using information trusted from the company. I think that shows why it was top of my list as the top national security lawyer as a threat. it's new. I mean, think about that alone. It crosses five different countries. It's multiple nationalities. And it puts the private sector on the front lines of national security threats like terrorism in a way that never has been there before. It's also a good example of the way that we fight back. The reason I can go into so many details in the book about that case is because we found Farizi in Malaysia. We arrested him with cooperation of the Malaysians. He was extradited back to the United States and sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2016, while Junaid, who was outside the reach of American law enforcement, was killed in a publicly acknowledged military strike by Central Command.
Lone wolf attacks are categorized as not orchestrated by organized terrorist networks, but by independent individuals. You say they don't really exist. What do you mean?
Well, we often find the so-called lone wolf has people who knew about or encouraged their radicalization. And either they have them in the real world, in the physical world, or they're meeting people online. And either it's terrorists like Junaid Hussein who are specifically targeting them, or they're entering echo chambers of radicalization and hate where they slowly start to believe that it's okay to move from an idea to violence. And that, by the way, is not something you just see with terrorist groups or nation states who try to exploit it. As the tragedy that we saw in Pittsburgh shows, it can also happen to those who are motivated by some domestic ideology. The key is trying to identify those people before the violence occurs so that you can reach them and prevent it from happening.
What's the goal? What's your goal with this book?
My goal is that we are already in a code war. And what I mean by that is there's a low-intensity conflict where every day, whether it's terrorists taking information to create kill lists, nation states stealing information, billions and billions of dollars in what the former director of National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, called the largest transfer of wealth in human history, or disruptive attacks, like the attacks to undermine our election, is to make sure people know that, number one, what is already happening. Number two, that we can change this dynamic before something really serious happens once we're educated about what the threats are. And number three, in the interim, before we make big changes, there's a lot of valuable lessons to be learned about the way we caught and disrupted people that can help protect you right now.
How is the cyber threat intensifying as we move more of our lives online?
Yeah, when you think about it, over a 25, 30-year period, we moved almost everything we value from books and papers, from analog to digital. And we did so without really thinking through what the risks are. And that's true in government and the private sector. And now we're playing catch-up because we see things like massive thefts of credit card and names and address information. We see things like the North Korean attack on Sony because they didn't like the content of a movie they made. That's where we are right now. As we look at where we're going to be, we're right on the cusp of really a revolution where we connect billions of new devices through the same insecure protocol, the internet. It just was never designed with security primarily in mind. And these new devices are physical. So we've already had instances, for example, of the pacemakers in our hearts that have been put inside people's bodies. And after they put the pacemaker in the body, they realized, hey, we tested to see whether this works. But what we didn't do is test to see whether it's safe if someone didn't want it to work, a crook, a terrorist, or a spy. And because it was rolled out without security in mind, they could see that an 11-year-old with publicly available software could hack and kill. Now, after realizing that and after the pacemaker was in people's hearts, they pushed out a patch. But, you know, think about, for your listeners out there and all of us, how many times we've had our computer stop working because it needed a patch. When it's the pacemaker in your heart or the car on our road or the drone in our sky, that's not good enough. So I think we're at a real inflection point where if we speak out to those who represent us, to our companies, we can get them to build security by design in before we start connecting all these physical devices.
John Carlin is the author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and the former Assistant Attorney General for National Security. How has the FBI tracking of potential threats changed since the Internet became prominent?
You know, in some ways, the FBI was created a federal law enforcement agency because of the advent of highways. It meant that people crossed state lines easily, and we needed a new approach to law enforcement. I think the Internet is having as profound an effect on the role and job of the FBI. I went over, after being a career prosecutor focusing on the criminal side of computer hacking cases, to the FBI to be chief of staff to then director of the FBI, Bob Mueller. And when I went over there, for the first time, I was able to see what was happening on the intelligence side of the house. And this was relatively recent. And what I saw was an amazing intelligence feat using national security methods where we could literally watch China in particular go into places like universities, hop through the Internet from the university to private businesses, and then we literally, they had a graphic user interface so you could see a visual. We'd watch this information, trade secrets, intellectual property, negotiation tactics, flow out of the United States, billions of dollars. And it became clear that this was not an intelligence problem. This was something that needed to be disrupted now. And I think you've seen the FBI move to that approach.
John Carlin, we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? 800-642-1234. Your calls next on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, I guess we're all on the front lines in this new global conflict called cyber war. We're in a cyber war. The question is, what are we doing about it? What questions do you have about America's cyber defenses? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. John Carlin is author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor, former attorney general for national security. We do have phone calls. Let's start with Jess in Appleton. Jess, welcome to The Morning Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
Hi, I just want to make a comment. I'm a developer, and what I'm noticing in multiple companies that I've worked for, one of the things that we could do is raise awareness a little bit more about cybersecurity and security in general, and that's among all departments. That's among the developers. That's among anybody who doesn't even want to work with a computer.
I think we lost him. All right, I think we got enough there, John, to kind of get an idea of where that question was going.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with your caller more. I think one of the key reforms I'd recommend is that everyone get educated. We're so dependent on cybersecurity that really it's wrong to call it cybersecurity. It's just security. It's what our economy depends on. It's what our health system depends on. So that means things like, I know, for instance, my daughter, when she was learning to read, she tried to swipe the page before we explained to her that's not how you read. So for kids who are going to be that engaged in the digital world, it should be in public school education across the country that you have a basic awareness of how to be safe online. And then that extends up. For instance, right now at some of our top universities like MIT, you don't learn cybersecurity as part of the basic curriculum. It's an elective. But everyone who codes should be taught about the dangers of cybersecurity. And the third issue is, it's just a great opportunity for those looking for jobs because there's an enormous skills gap between what our executives and business leaders are saying they need and the current skills of our workforce. So we need initiatives to help retrain people who want to get into this field.
What role can Silicon Valley play in our cyber defenses?
They are so on the front lines in a variety of ways. We talked a little bit about the way terrorists have exploited social media, and we saw Russia do the same thing. And to a different extent, Iran recently, Facebook talked about how they were putting out essentially fake news to try to exacerbate tensions inside the United States. So Silicon Valley companies can help come up with the technology to stop and prevent that type of behavior. And also, long-term, I hope innovate our way out of this problem. As dependent as we are now on our iPhones and laptops, many of us remember an age not too long ago where that was not the case. So maybe we can innovate our way into a more secure technology.
Let's take another call. Matt joins us from Hartford. Matt, hello.
Hello. I'm just wondering, since a lot of times what is old is new again, what is the FBI's, task force or whatever, on protecting our critical information like nuclear secrets and things like that? I'm just worried that this focus on individual cybersecurity might draw away from that. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Matt, thanks for the question. John Carlin?
I think that's exactly right, Matt. The first priority has been critical infrastructure. So a focus on how to protect against those who would go after our nuclear power, our electrical grid, our water supply. Remember one case that we brought that we talk about in the book of Iranian hackers linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, who we had indicted for attacking our financial system, 47 different financial institutions, but they also had hacked into the Bowman Dam in Rye, New York. And what they did is they accessed the sluice control systems so they'd be able to lift up the dam and flood the surrounding area. Now, it happens the dam was down for physical maintenance at the time, but none of us felt good that crumbling physical infrastructure was going to be our best defense against cyber attacks. So I think it was a good lesson at how we need to protect critical infrastructure. The other thing we learned, though, to Matt's question, is sometimes what we value most is not a thing. So we spend a lot of our laws, regulations, and approach were built about around that infrastructure. But one thing from the North Korean attack on Sony Motion Pictures, we wargamed for years what it would look like if a rogue nuclear-armed nation tried to attack the United States through cyber means, and we never imagined that it would be about a movie about a bunch of pot smokers. It's the only time in my career I went to brief the president in the Situation Room and had to start by giving a plot summary. And for those of you that have seen the interview, it's not an easy movie to summarize because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's a comedy. Mm. So the reason why we took that so seriously, though, is it wasn't an attack on the movie. It was an attack on the right to free speech, a core value in the United States that was being meddled with by a regime overseas that doesn't share our values. And we saw the same type of attack on our system, in this case, democracy, with the Russian attempts to interfere in our election. So as we think about what's critical infrastructure and what the FBI's priorities need to be, it needs to be not just the things or stuff, but also attacks on our core values and systems.
Just yesterday, the Justice Department charged three people and two Chinese companies with theft of trade secrets from an Idaho-based technology company. In addition, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a new initiative to combat this kind of cyber theft. Is this initiative a step in the right direction to protect our economy from cyber war?
Yeah, I think the initiative that the Attorney General announced is a step in the right direction, and it's a continuation of the story that we're telling in the book, where the first case we brought against uniformed members of the Chinese military was just in 2014. It was a unit called 61398, and we laid out how that unit's day job, they got up every morning, went to work in their uniform, their day job was to hack into American companies solely for economic benefit. And we showed with an attachment in the case that that conduct started at 9 in the morning Beijing time, went from 9 to noon. They took a one-hour lunch break because the activity decreased from noon to 1, up again in Hacken from 1 to 6, decreased overnight, weekends, and Chinese holidays. And the prosecutor in me calls that circumstantial evidence. But the broader point is that means the second largest military in the world is targeting private companies. And if they're left on their own to deal with that, they can't. They don't have the resources. So the initiative that is going to be spearheaded by my successor in my old division says we're going to use all tools, criminal prosecutions, civil suits, Treasury Department sanctions, Commerce Department authorities, to increase the cost of that type of economic theft until the conduct changes.
As you know, there's a big election coming up next Tuesday. As we go forward, how do we as a country ensure that our elections are free from foreign interference?
That's why it's so important to learn and study and know these stories about what's already happened in the past. Once you do, you can come up with creative ways to protect yourself. I use the example of the French president, Macron, was running, and he saw what Russia did in our 2016 election. He knew they were going to come for his campaign and hack into it. What his campaign did was, knowing the bad guy is going to be inside the system, they deliberately put email traffic in that was not true. And then when predictably the Russian hackers stole and released that information to try to embarrass them, they told the mainstream media, hey guys, if we're not going to tell you what's true or not true, so if you publish this, you won't know. And it worked. It kept them from publishing it. He successfully won the presidency. That's a good lesson for all of us in business and the private sector. You know, if you assume that there's no wall you can build that's high enough to keep a dedicated intruder out of your system, then don't put the things you value most in a folder called crown jewels, right? Bad idea.
And John Carlin, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
John Carlin is the author of the book Dawn of the Code War, America's Battle Against Russia, China, and the Rising Global Cyber Threat. He's a career federal prosecutor and former assistant attorney general for national security. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.